Thank you, Sean. Good reminder for us of God's mercy and sternness, that he is a just and a loving God. And of course, his justice and his love met perfectly at the cross, didn't it? Last week, Sean spoke of the duty that we have as Christians to vote, and you'll remember that he referenced Acts chapter 17, reminding us that we are not here by our own choice, but rather that God has determined the times that have been set for us and the exact places where we should live so that men would seek him and find him. And he challenged us with the fact that God has not assigned us to this time and place in history to simply sit by passively and watch others act. He read the parable of the talents from Luke chapter 10, where we read, "From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded." And he made the point that as U.S. citizens, as United States citizens, we have been given much and that we have a duty to steward that which we, that which has been entrusted to us. He also pointed out that because ours is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, that the power actually rests in us, that we actually are the government in a very real sense. And that just as God expected Judah's and Israel's kings to use their power for good, so too he expects you and I to use our power, in this case, our vote, for good. So Sean spoke last week briefly at the end of his message there, or at the end of after Pastor Phil's message, about the duty to vote. And I want to take just a few minutes to share principles that should inform how we should vote in this election, and really in every election. I want to speak first very briefly to the role of the church with respect to politics and voting in a general sense, because I realize that some maybe weren't here last week, or maybe you're visiting for the first time this week, and so for your benefit, I want to do that. I realize that some people might find it objectionable or even unbiblical for the church to address these subjects, that being voting and politics, from the pulpit. To be clear, God has not called the church to become a political animal. Our pastors and our elders do not believe that the answer to man's sin problem or the answer to our nation's problems is found in a president or in a political party. Psalm 33, verse 16, makes this very clear. No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. And so, too, we could say that a political party or a president is a vain hope for deliverance. Michael Horton, a theologian, wisely wrote, quote, "Political solutions are not ultimate for the same reason that medical solutions are not ultimate. In the end, we all die from something." I think that's well said. But this doesn't mean that as Christians that we should abandon our responsibility to use our vote to mitigate evil and to promote the common good. God calls pastors to train their flocks to think and to act biblically and according to biblical principles. Ephesians 4:11 and 12, it was he, Christ, who gave some to be pastors and teachers to prepare God's people for works of service so that the body of Christ might be built up. That's the role of your pastors and your elders. Pastors are responsible. Think about it. They are responsible to teach us how to treat our spouses, how to raise our children, how to manage our finances, how to behave sexually. Doesn't it make sense then that the shepherd's duty is to teach us how to vote, how to interact with the culture through the political process? This unbiblical mentality that says that the church should just stay out of politics has no biblical grounds and has crippled the church's influence throughout our culture in our nation and has severely damaged our gospel witness. Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch theologian and statesman, said this: "In the total expanse of human life, there is not a single square inch of which Christ, who is alone sovereign, does not declare, 'That is mine.'" So in other words, Jesus Christ is Lord of our marriages, he's Lord of our families, our money, our sexuality, and he is Lord of our vote. We are not free as followers of Jesus Christ to enter into the voting booth guided by self-interest. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves." As we consider who to vote for, we should not be asking the question, which candidate will benefit me or my personal interests? In other words, which candidate will promise to forgive my school loan? Or which candidate will promise me health care? Or which candidate will guarantee a $15 an hour minimum wage? Instead, we ought to be asking the questions, how can I best honor God with my vote? How can I use my vote to bring about the best possible outcome for my country and for the weak, the vulnerable, and the oppressed? Now, I will admit that sometimes answering that question isn't easy. Sometimes it's very nuanced and very difficult to know which candidate or which party is going to be the best, to accomplish those things. But this is not one of those times. This is clearly not one of those times in our nation's history. Thoughtful Christians give greater worth or greater weight to greater moral issues. That's a very important principle here. Thoughtful Christians give greater weight to greater moral issues. As pro-lifers, we are not single-issue voters. Now, I'm speaking here sort of collectively because I'm assuming most of you are guided by that principle or by that ethic. But we are not single-issue voters. We care as Christians, we should care as Christians, deeply about many, many issues. And I do, and I know many of you do as well. And we should be fighting all kinds of social ills and standing up for all kinds of unrighteousness, or standing up against unrighteousness, I'm sorry. But we do recognize the legalized murder of unborn children by abortion as the single most pressing moral issue. It's not the only issue, but it is the single greatest issue. It is the premier human rights issue of our day, and one that should weigh heavily on the votes that we cast. And by the way, have you ever noticed that no other voting bloc is ever accused of being single issue? Only pro-lifers, only Christians, which shows you the contempt many have, even many professing Christians, that they have for the unborn. Some political positions, because of their moral impact on individuals and society, disqualify a candidate from receiving our vote as Christians. This is not a complicated or controversial point. Almost everyone agrees with this. For instance, we would never vote for a candidate of either party who had all the right positions on immigration, the environment, the economy, etc., but supported a law granting husbands the right to beat their wives. You would not vote for that candidate, would you? So, too, we would not consider for a moment voting for a candidate who supported a law that granted parents the right to kill their toddlers. This would be repulsive and would clearly disqualify that candidate from getting our vote. Now, that said, the first and the most critical duty of the state or the government is to protect the weak from the strong. Yet we live in a day when one presidential candidate has set his jaw against the weakest and the most vulnerable among us, the least of these, the preborn targeted by elective abortion. And more than ever before, our preborn brothers and sisters are in the crosshairs of a party that has made its intentions abundantly clear should they win the presidency on November 3rd. Among other things, the Democrat Party has promised to codify Roe v. Wade into law, to abolish the Hyde Amendment, which prevents taxpayer dollars from funding abortion through Medicaid reimbursements, and which has been responsible for saving the lives of well over 2 million children. They have promised to abolish the filibuster so that pro-lifers cannot stop any pro-abortion legislation that they put forth. And presidential candidate Joe Biden, who, by the way, is endorsed by Planned Parenthood, that should tell you something, has finally admitted this week what we have known all along, that he is indeed considering packing the Supreme Court. And we can be certain that if he does this, if he is elected president, that he will do so with liberal pro-abortion justices who will effectively destroy the influence of our more conservative justices for decades to come. There are several articles now, and I'm sure many of you have seen these, that are making the rounds on social media that attempt to redefine for us what they think the pro-life movement ought to be or how it ought to be defined. They argue that being pro-life means more than opposing abortion, and then they throw a million leftist causes into what Scott Klusendorf rightly refers to as a stew of moral equivalency. And what they are really arguing is that no candidate is completely pro-life, and so therefore voting pro-life really doesn't matter. It shouldn't be a consideration in how we cast our votes. This is an effort, a clear effort, to siphon away pro-life votes, Christian votes, from a president who, as imperfect as he is, has pledged and has proven his support for the unborn. But to vote for a party or a candidate that has shamelessly declared their intention to do whatever possible to promote abortion is to declare that you believe the unborn are unworthy of your protection as well. Even worse, it is to actively join the effort to deny your unborn neighbors this protection. It is easy to diminish the importance that the issue of abortion should play in how we vote, when abortion remains abstract in our thinking, and I don't mean in your thinking necessarily, but most people who support abortion and who find it comfortable to vote for candidates who are hell-bent on denying the most fundamental right to the unborn are ambivalent about abortion because they have never seen abortion in all of its ugliness. You know, at least if you've been a part of Aletheia for any period of time, that we have on occasion over the years shown a short victim imagery video. It's one that I show in my travels in high schools and in other settings. And it's a victim imagery video that's less than a minute long. It shows an abortion being performed. We're not going to show that this morning. But I am going to, in just a minute here, show you two still photos of aborted babies. One is a first trimester abortion. One is a third trimester abortion, both legal under Roe v. Wade in the United States. But I want to say just a word about that before I show it. First of all, you don't have to look at this if you choose not to. We will respect that. This will be between you and the Lord. You can easily avert your gaze or close your eyes if you prefer to do that. But I do want to plead with you, if you have not seen abortion in all of its ugliness, or if you have not come to the conclusion that this should weigh heavily on your vote, then I want to plead with you this morning to look at these two photos. I know this is very unconventional, I guess, for churches to show this, but it shouldn't be, because Paul has actually given us our marching orders in Ephesians 5:11 when he said, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. This is the job of the church. And we wouldn't have, I'm convinced, or at least I think I'm convinced, we would not have legalized abortion in America 40 years later after Roe v. Wade, 6 years later after Roe v. Wade, if churches did their job and exposed this evil. I want to say one more thing, and that is this. I realize that some here have had abortions or have been responsible for abortion decisions, and I hope you know my heart and the heart of your leadership here, of which I'm not a part anymore, but I hope you know the heart of this church, that it is not to heap abuse or guilt on anyone. It is, we're not showing videos or photos like I'm going to show today to shock or to manipulate, but rather to educate. And so if you have been hurt by abortion, you have an abortion experience in your past, know this. There is no sin so evil or so bad, but that the grace of God is not greater still. And that forgiveness is available to anyone who seeks Him, confesses their sin, whatever that sin is. He promises to forgive us and to free us of the penalty of sin as well. So with no further ado, I'm going to just bring this to close. I'm going to show these two photos. We'll go ahead and do that now. And then a couple closing comments here. If we go ahead and show those. I know those are hard to see. Maybe you're seeing them this morning for the first time. But that's what abortion does to little girls and boys. We're not the extremists for opposing abortion. And we're not the extremists for making this the single most important issue when we go into the voting booth. Isaiah 5:20 says, woe to those who call evil good, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. It has been said, I'm sure you've heard it said, that our vote is the currency of our virtue. But what virtue is left when we vote to empower a party or a president or a candidate that defends and promotes doing this to helpless, precious, preborn children. The destruction of human beings by legalized abortion is not just another issue any more than slavery was just another issue in 1860. This is the defining moral issue of our day. This is our Goliath as a church. And finally, we should keep in mind that every vote during every election cycle is in some respect a vote for the lesser of two evils. We are not voting for a personality or a pastor. We are voting for a platform more than ever before, a platform that we believe will best represent biblical positions. I trust that's the platform that you're voting for. And then 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 7, love always protects. Love always protects. Think about that as you vote. Think about that as you interact with other people on social media and over these next couple of weeks.